House Judiciary is called to order at whatever time it is, 1:05 on Wednesday, February 16th. Present are Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Thompson, and myself, Chair Gatto. First order of day business, if you own one of these things like mine, that's on, just hit the off button. Have two bills, HB 8, Federal Regulations and Executive Orders, with the sponsor sitting to my immediate left, and a much easier one. And I think we should take HB 116 first, correct spelling of lorazepam. Is there somebody that is going to speak to correct spelling of lorazepam? Jerry Luckup? Jerry, hiding outside. We have a spelling test?
First you have to say it, though.
So, Senor Luckup, would you introduce yourself? Tell us the all the ramifications of HB 116, and we'll get a vote on it. And by the way, we've been joined by Representative Lynn. So, Jerry, you have the floor.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jerry Luckup, Assistant Revisor of Statutes for the Alaska Legislature. Through the chair, this is a special revisor's bill. There's another revisor's bill that's starting in the Senate this year that has all the other 30-some changes to things that have become outmoded in statutes, things like that. Traditionally, Pam Finley as revisor and Dave Dierdorf for her usually didn't want to put criminal things in the revisor's bill because it has an effect or can have such an effect on past convictions and those issues. So she suggested we do a separate revisor's bill to fix this misspelling of lorazepam. It was misspelled by the legislature in 1982 as lorazepam. No one noticed it until last year, and so part of the reason for doing the special revisor's bill is we need an applicability section to go along with that, saying that this is a mere technical change. We aren't trying to change any law here. And so people that might have been convicted for possessing lorazepam in the past, everyone knows that we meant lorazepam back in 1982, and everything should be fine. There's always problems when someone might have been convicted of something, possessing something that doesn't exist or something like that, but
How would that be treated in the courts? Someone comes back now and says, I'm innocent.
Someone can make that argument, but that's kind of why I designed the applicability clause as I did, saying that, you know, obviously this was a mere clerical mistake at some point by the Alaska legislature back in 1982, and we meant lorazepam all along. And so remains to be seen. I don't think there will be any problem with any past convictions or any current prosecutions. The idea of strict code pleading that used to exist kind of went away 50 years ago or so, and so there should not be a problem. But if there is a problem, the applicability clause tries to fix it as best we can. I've talked to the Department of Law, Deborah Baer and Annie Carpinetti both agree that this is the best way to fix this problem, and that's it. Slowly, I have less to say today than the other day.
There's a lot of other PAMs in the list. And this one, who is the genius that said, that looks wrong?
Well, it came up last year with a prosecution up in Fairbanks. There was actually, I think, an assistant district attorney that was arrested for driving under the influence of something. And they discovered he was taking lorazepam, which is Valium, which affected his driving. And he was actually, I think, arrested twice within a two-week period. And they noticed along the lines that, gee, it says lorazepam here. I thought this was lorazepam. And that's how it came to our attention. And it was in a bill or two last session trying to fix it right at the end of session, and that some people had added it to a couple criminal law bills, but it didn't get through. And the process that occurs at the end of session.
Representative Pruitt.
Speaking of the individual, the way that we found this, once we had figured out that it was spelled incorrect, did that affect the prosecution of that individual?
Through the chair, Representative Frewitt, it didn't have any effect at all. I think the way they dealt with it in the case was they just recognized this as a misspelling in the statutes, however it occurred. All of these PAM drugs that are in Schedule 3 are all things like lorazepam. They're these kind of mood-altering drugs that hopefully calm you down a bit. And Valium is the most common one, lorazepam, and from what I understand, it had no effect on the prosecution up there.
Just follow up. So was understanding the intent behind it, is that what prevented them from using this, that it was legally, legalistically it was spelled wrong, but the intent behind it was there?
Through the chair, Representative Frewitt, I think that's what the court did there. They recognized what the legislature was actually intending to do. They weren't trying to criminalize the possession of something that doesn't exist, but we're trying to criminalize lorazepam, Valium, which does exist.
Okay, thank you.
Could we have gotten the drug companies to change the spelling?
Put that in statute.
Representative Thompson.
Yes. It's been brought to my attention that there's a couple other misspelled words in the same one. 1171-140, Schedule 1A, on B10 is oxymorphine, should be oxymorphone.
That's true.
And then in 1171-170, Schedule IVA, F3, proxfene should be proxyfene, proproxyfene, not propox, without a Y. It doesn't have the Y in the way it's written. So we've got two other misspellings. Can these be done now, or does that take a separate?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, until I've been able to figure out if they're actual misspellings or not, or we went through a process for lorazepam to make sure that it wasn't just some clerical error in the statute books and was actually something the legislature did. The last one, propoxyphene, which you're referring to, is a mere misspelling by LexisNexis in the statute books. The legislature passed propoxyphene, and so that is not something that requires a legislative change at all. The oxymorphine is actually listed by DEA as oxymorphine and as oxymorphone. And so I would be hesitant to make a change until I've been able to, or to recommend a change as I'm required to do for the reviser statute, until I've been able to clarify that. The schedule lists oxymorphone, but DEA, when they describe what's in the schedule, they list it as oxymorphine. And I've copied those pages off from the DEA website. So I would be a little hesitant to do that right now.
You're going to change them now.
Yeah.
I can see another bill coming, but that will be with your name on it. Okay. I think that's plenty of testimony, unless some member of the committee has another comment. Anyone in the audience want to comment? Anyone online want to comment? We have Doug Moody. Doug Moody, are you a public defender? Are you online?
This is Douglas Moody, Chairman Gatto.
Thank you. Do you have some comments to make?
No, I don't have anything further to what Mr. Lockup said.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Luckup, I think, covered it very well. So if there's no one else online, I will close public testimony, bring it back to the committee. The wishes of the committee are, anyone want to move this bill forward so we can vote on it? Representative Thompson.
Chairman Gatto, I would move that we advance House Bill number 116 with attached physical note and recommendations of the committee.
Is there a physical note on this? There is.
Yes, there
wow.
is.
Hope it's not a lot.
It's a zero.
Oh, it's a zero. Okay. That's good. I mean, somebody might have to revise some books. Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing no objection, this bill moves from committee as structured by, not as structured, but as stated by Representative Thompson. Thank you very much. You're leaving. You know, we have some other stuff right now, too, that might. Well, we like double barrel stuff. No, enjoy your day. Thank you. Okay, Representative Wes Keller, sitting on my immediate left, has a bill that he is a sponsor of. It's called House Bill 8, Federal Regulations and Executive Orders.
We'll get a minute to sign before you get down.
So, Representative Keller, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. And with your indulgence, can I bring my staff up here?
Please. Escape quickly. And Mr. Pound, you're going to introduce yourself.
We'll do that. For the record, my name is Jim Pound, staff representative Wes Keller.
Thank you.
Okay, HB 8 is addressed at something that I think is becoming increasingly obvious, and that is that our the sovereignty of the state is threatened, sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly, and it's in response to that. One source of the problem, as I see it, is the volume of federal regulations that come out. Based on the congressional laws that are written by bureaucrats, not elected people, and sometimes we just don't pay enough attention to them to know whether or not they're valid and whether they should be something that we comply with or not. HB 8 merely tells the Attorney General to keep up on federal regs and executive orders and then report to the respective judiciary committees if they see a problem, a constitutional problem, or a regulation or an executive order that is improperly adopted. That's it. It's a simple bill, and I wish it was that simple, to discuss, but there's a little bit more to it than that. One is the Department of Law, I think when they come up, I think they gave you an amendment there. They have told me that they can't possibly keep up with all the regulations, and I very sincerely believe that. The last I heard on when the healthcare bill was going through, for every page of law, it generates 100 pages of regulations. So the 2,000-page healthcare law, that's 200,000 pages of regulations that come out from the department, and we can't expect our Department of Law, of course, to be up there going through every word of it. They have proposed an amendment that is before you in the last part of it. H is, as I read it, okay. You know, what it does is it softens it. Instead of saying you have to read everything, it's that if you see a problem, be sure you let the judiciary know, and it sounds like a reasonable fix. There's part of that amendment that got my blood pressure probably doubled, and I came in here ready to bite a nail into, but I understand that it's not as significant to the Department of Law, but I want to point it out because I do not want to lose that part of the bill. If you look at the bill itself, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to read a portion that was going to be deleted that was actually the axiomatic theme of the bill. And it starts on page 2, line 10. I'm sorry.
You're talking about section...
Section 2?
Section 2, yes.
Line 8.
And the part that was is proposed as an amendment before you to replace line, or to delete, I should say, lines 9 through 20 is what I object to, and as I understand, that's okay with the Department of Law. You'll hear from him later, and you'll be able to ask him. But may I read it,
sir? Please do.
Starting on line 10, federal preemption effect of certain federal regulations and presidential orders. A federal regulation or presidential executive order that is unconstitutional or was not properly adopted in accordance with federal statutory authority may not be considered to preempt a state law. And then section 3 there, there's an amendment by adding a new section starting on page 15, federal regulations and executive orders. After receiving a report from the Attorney General under AS 4423020H, that's the bill, part of the bill down below here, that a state law is in conflict with a federal regulation or presidential executive order that is unconstitutional or was not properly adopted in accordance with federal statutory authority, the House and the Senate committees having jurisdiction over judicial matters may each consider whether the legislative action, whether legislative action is necessary in response to the finding by the Attorney General. It's important to me that that stay in the bill. I don't mind, of course, the wordsmithing, and I think you can read my intent there, but I would really like to retain that part of the bill. So with that, I would like to ask my chief of staff, he and I have not compared notes real well because of the busy schedule, and I want to make sure that there's something he may want to add, but that concludes my presentation.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I did have a, one comment. I guess we're all either elected officials or bureaucrats. All of our staff are bureaucrats, I guess. But on unconstitutional, the question coming up, is something unconstitutional only after the United States Supreme Court says it is? Or if we think something is unconstitutional, and we can all think of bills like that, for example, the health care debate, Roe v. Wade, other thing, many of us think those might be unconstitutional, but are they in fact unconstitutional before the United States Supreme Court says so? You see why I'm going to that?
Oh, through the chair, Representative Lynn, to me, that could get me going a whole evening's discussion. It's delightful information. The fact that you go back to the Constitution when it was ratified by the states, it was very, very, very clear that the states maintained their sovereignty over any federal agency branch, including the federal government. And there's been numerous cases where the states have stood up with various results, you know. And I mean, the you know, like I say, that's a discussion that we could spend a lot of time on, and that'd be up to the chair. And if we do that, I would love to come in and make a presentation and make my case rather than just a quick response. But, you know, a quick response is that the state sovereignty is there, and we have the right to challenge whether or not it's a Supreme Court decision.
I agree. But until we challenge it, and after we challenge it, then the Supreme Court makes a decision. Is it at that point it becomes unconstitutional, or are we just alleging it is unconstitutional in the meantime? I just really want to know that, because it makes a difference how we look at this.
I think that's one for Mr. Ford. I'm going to ask you to come up here and help with comments. And on the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Ford. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And also online is Joanne Grace, who is the head of our appeals section. And I think she will also have some enlightenment to give you on this subject. I can speak to it a little bit. I think that's a very good question. In my view, part of the issue raised by this bill is, at what point do we know that there is a preemption issue? We really don't know that until we have a ruling by a court. We can have views on matters. I can give you one example, which would be our health care dilemma. We have courts with different views on that. Until the U.S. Supreme Court rules, do we really know, though, with finality, whether there is a preemption issue or not? We don't.
See, that's really the point. We think the Supreme Court decision, not the Supreme Court, the federal decision was unconstitutional. They think the opposite. At this point, do we have to act on the law that was passed if we still think it was unconstitutional? Or can we ignore the law that was passed without consequence? Because that's what House Bill 1 is going to try to do. So many other issues that are going to require us to enact an exchange program, $1 million from the feds to do it. It's almost like a bribe. Say, hey, I'll give you $1 million if you will do something that indicates that the law is constitutional. That's my same difficulty. Representative Lind expressed it clearly. If indeed the Constitution says what it says, everything is unconstitutional that we say is unconstitutional until a law decides we were wrong, or is everything constitutional as long as the feds say it until we decide that a law was wrong? That's no guidance.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're making good points. I mean, the principles are easy to speak to and to describe, but the application of the principles is very difficult. We can say there is a line beyond which the federal government cannot go because those are rights reserved to the states. But depicting that line, deciding, okay, here is where it is what this litigation is all about. And it often is very difficult to come to. Yes.
So, I'm sorry, should we go online and get the alternative opinion?
We could certainly ask Joanne to weigh in if she has more thoughts.
I'm going to ask. Joanne, are you online?
This is Joanne Grace.
Hold on one second. Representative Keller, did you want to make a statement?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that the issue may not be whether or not there's consequence. You know, in other words, what the Supreme Court decides it to do, whatever action is taken against us, really isn't the question here. And, in fact, the bill doesn't go there. It leaves this question for the particular situation where we get notification from the Attorney General that there may be a problem here. Then we have to deal with that, what the state does in response. And we can't pre-solve that problem because every circumstance is different. So that I hesitate to, I mean, that's your call as chair and as a committee, whether or not you want to get into this discussion or not. But it's a big one, and it's one that's been around for a long time, and it's going to be around for a lot longer. But this bill doesn't go there. This bill just says to the Attorney General, if you see a problem, please call it to the attention of the judiciary of both houses, and then the determination can be made how to respond, you know, as to what we do with it. So, thanks.
So, Joanne, do you have any comments you can add?
For the record, it's Joanne Grace. I'm an assistant attorney general from the Department of Law. I think I can add sort of the technical answer to the question that may not be entirely practical. But when a court like the Supreme Court finds a law to be unconstitutional, it will always have been unconstitutional. It won't only be unconstitutional from that point forward. But until you have that decision from a federal court, if you choose not to follow the law, you would do it at your own peril. You couldn't, the federal government may still enforce a law against you. But as I understand HB 8, it would be relying on an opinion of the Attorney General. And I think that the Attorney General's office in general is pretty prudent about giving this kind of advice in the sense that we wouldn't say something was definitely unconstitutional unless it was so clearly unconstitutional that we felt confident to say that. We would probably hedge that opinion a little bit if we felt, you know, there was some chance a court may say it is constitutional or not constitutional.
So let me ask you a different question then. The Commerce Clause and the Affordable Health Care Act, in your opinion or in other opinions that you've heard from, it's not even conceivable to me that the Commerce Clause could be applied so broadly. So my feeling is, what do we do? Do we spend the money instituting all the programs required under the law, assuming that we will win later on and be able to undo them? Or do we do it because we can assume that it will be shown constitutional and we'll be glad we had them in place? We have to make an action that could be worth millions of dollars, if not tens of millions, based on, gosh, we're laymen, what we think the Supreme Court will say. And if we went to you and Mr. Ford and the Attorney General and said, what do you think we ought to do?
And you'd say, well, it depends. That's the problem we always have. Of course it depends. I can't predict the Supreme Court's decision, except I cannot imagine the
to reach assistance, being press 0. To enter a breakout session, press 1. To dial a phone number or get all missing invitees, press 3. For waiting admittance options, press 4. To mute your phone, press 5. For recordings, press 6. For Q&A options, press 7. For advanced features, press 8. To exit the meeting and return to the main menu.
The last thing we were doing was getting some comments from the chair on the Commerce Clause, directed to Ms. Grace from the Department of Law. And I'm not sure if you want to comment on my comments on the Commerce Clause. Do you?
This is Joanne Grace again. I may have missed the end of the question. But the part of the question I heard was, how do we know how to proceed with the Affordable Health Care Act if we don't know how a court is going to rule? And the answer to that is, it is a difficult situation, and I'm certainly no expert in the Affordable Health Care Act, and we do have people who are. But in general, if you ask for legal opinion, an attorney is going to tell you what he or she thinks a court will do. And in this context, I think at this point we have two federal courts who have gone one way and two federal courts who have gone the other way. So I very much doubt you would get a really firm legal opinion from any attorney on this question.
The most recent court decision, does it make any difference in the order that the decisions were made?
I apologize. I don't know who's speaking, if it's the chair or if it's somebody else.
This is the chair.
Okay, Chair Mercado. It does not matter what order the decisions are made in. I think it may be of some significance that Alaska is a party to the Florida District Court case. But again, I hesitate to speak at length about this case because we have several attorneys who are really knowledgeable about it, and I'm not one of them. But in general, no, it would not make a difference. Just the order of the decisions would not make a difference. What makes a difference is the level of the court and whether Alaska is bound by that court. So if it were a Ninth Circuit court, that might be different than a Second Circuit court, but it does make a difference that we're a party in the Florida case.
Okay, and so if the Supreme Court were to rule against us, that is that the Commerce Clause did allow for the Affordable Health Care Plan, and we have done nothing right up to the time they make their decision, are we liable for making up past claims that people might have had? We're going to be sued if somebody passes away and says, you know, with the Health Care Act, that person would have been able to see 28 doctors and receive 52 medicines and consequently never died. I don't know. We look for guidance all the time. And, of course, on legal issues like this, we look for guidance to the Department of Law, which is you.
Thank you, Chairman Goddard. I'm part of the Department of Law. We have a team of people who are very knowledgeable about this act, and I would not give you an accurate answer, I'm afraid.
Well, you would fit right in because I don't think there are any accurate answers until we look into the future about a year or a year and a half and listen to the decisions of the Supreme Court. I just didn't know, and I think we might know this, though, are we liable if indeed the Supreme Court rules against what I think they ought to do? Is there somebody out there that's going to sue us for being sick because we did not institute the law of the land, which is what it is at the moment?
Chairman Gatto, that may depend on exactly how the law is written. I think it is possible that if we're not up to speed and ready to go with the law, we might put some Alaskans in a difficult situation. But again, I really hesitate to talk about this law because I don't know what I'm talking about.
I mean, it's so easy to do, what with pre-existing illnesses and students up to age 26, or is it just children up to age 26 with certain exceptions? Clearly, those two things could be monstrous, and we have not done anything to accept that as our obligation. Anyway, I thank you. Thank you for your time. I know putting you in the barrel like that and saying, what are we supposed to do? And you're only one person. Maybe we ought to get the Attorney General to tell us what we're supposed to do during the time while we're waiting for the Supreme Court to act. Well, one more. Is it possible the Supreme Court could simply not take this case?
Chairman Gatto, it's possible, but I think it's very unlikely, because it looks like, because the courts are already so split, the Supreme Court would be very likely to accept a petition for certiorari if there were two different circuit courts who had conflicting opinions. And it's also obviously an issue of important national interest, so I think it's probably inevitable that the court will take it. But the court can always decline to take any case.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Lynn?
I wonder if...
Is this for Joanne or for us?
Well, for Joanne. It's the same question I asked before. Is something unconstitutional before it's declared unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court? Or Alaska Supreme Court, for that matter.
She said it's unconstitutional the whole time. Once it's declared unconstitutional, it never was constitutional.
But between now and then.
No, I think we're off the hook if it's declared unconstitutional. And the last judge declared the whole law unconstitutional based on severability clause. So I feel comfortable in proceeding as if the law will be declared unconstitutional. But I'm only a person who has an opinion. Representative Pruitt.
I'll kind of want to follow up on actually what you just said, is that it's been declared unconstitutional so far by one court, but that court obviously is, I believe, are two.
Two and two.
And they're district courts, correct?
Yes.
I think so, yeah. The ninth, I don't know if the ninth district even acted on it, but one in Florida acted on it. It's two and two.
They're both federal courts.
And so that their ruling applies to just their areas or the states that are involved? Or is it blanket over the whole United States? Where does their ruling apply is, I think, the question.
And I guess we joined the lawsuit, the Florida lawsuit, so yeah. We're a part of the action, believe me, I'm guessing here. We're part of their decision. I mean, that's why it's a lawsuit of 21 states, or is it more?
I don't know if
Representative Pruitt?
The caller, I can't remember. I don't know if she's able to respond to that.
Joanne Grace?
Yes.
Oh, Joanne Grace, can you comment on what Representative Pruitt asked?
Yeah, through the chair, generally it would bind the parties and it would be effective in the district that's covered by the court. It's a little bit of an awkward situation when we're talking about a national law and the United States is one of the parties, because effectively it would mean that the United States is bound to enforce the law as to 25 states, but not as to 25 others, and that's just not the way the federal government operates. That's one of the reasons why this is very likely to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court, because there has to be uniformity in how this law affects the country.
In the future, House Bill 1 will come before us, which simply states that no one can be compelled to buy a product that they do not want to buy. If it goes through the House and the Senate and signed by the governor, that probably adds to our ability to justify refusing to follow the Affordable Health Care Law, I guess. I'm going to be a lawyer someday where I don't have to ask. Representative Pruitt.
I just wanted to follow up. So to make sure, right now, health care law as it applies to Alaska is that it is unconstitutional And therefore, and I'm asking that based on kind of the conversation that was taking place earlier. So by not implementing aspects of that law, we are not in essentially in violation of a federal law, correct?
It is the law.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, was that question directed at me?
I would love to have you your take on it.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. Through the chair, it's not clear to me, and this just may be because I'm not an expert on the Act, that there's anything that the state needs to be doing right at the moment other than possibly getting ready to implement the law when it goes into effect. So I don't know that we would be violating a federal law by doing nothing. But there may be a point where if we haven't prepared and a higher court finds the law to be constitutional, that we may not be ready to implement the law when we're required to.
True. Now, some parts of the law require the collection of taxes to support the program. And I always wondered if that part of the law, I mean, when you get a bill from the IRS, you could say, wait a second, this much money was part of the Affordable Health Care Act, which I think is unconstitutional. They've heard that argument a zillion times, and they always collect their money. So we'll probably be stuck paying certain taxes to support the bill. I'm guessing, but I think that's the way it's happening. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And who's this topic? Question, who's this for?
This is actually a comment, and Joanne can respond. But I just wanted to, to orient ourselves. This is not the topic of the bill, and that's fine. That's a prerogative of the committee. But I just want to please understand that the bill was not brought forward because of or to address the health care law. That was not the issue. The issue is strictly broader than that. It's just to notify. Thank you for letting me put that on the record, because I was sitting here squirming, thinking, this isn't about the health care law. That's the only thing I wanted to say. I mean, it is indirectly, but no.
Okay. We had a questions, gentlemen? Mr. Ford.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just finish my comments on House Bill 8. That might be helpful. I did propose some new language, and in my zeal, I took it to heart to try and improve the representative's bill. But really, our concern is only addressing Section 4. That's the one that concerns us. And I did propose some new language that I believe will narrow the scope that would alleviate our concerns. And I just wanted to make that clear to the committee.
Representative Keller, Section 4, the Attorney General shall review federal regulations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, as far as I read the amendment, which was just before the committee, I see no problem with the amendment as proposed for Section 4, subpart H, page 2, lines 22, I believe, through 29. It seemed like a very good wording of what I intended, except that it says leaves the word if in there. If the Attorney General sees a problem with a regulation or executive order, they can bring the report to us. And I think that's a reasonable request by the Department of Law, just because of the volume of regulations we're talking about. Like Mr. Ford said to me, they don't want to build a new wing on over there right now. So.
Going to close public testimony unless someone online jumps on and wants to hear. Oh, I'm sorry. We have Stuart Thompson. Stuart Thompson, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Here's your chance to testify. Give us, we got your name. Are you affiliated with any organization?
No, I am not.
Okay, go ahead and give us your testimony.
Okay. I'm Stuart Thompson, citizen residing in Wasilla, representing my sovereign citizenship. Start a 3-minute prepared testimony. Sorry for inconsistency with new developments. I testify in support of House Bill Number 8 and commend the sponsors for acting in acute compliance to their oath of office. The most deadly means of overthrowing our former multi-level republic, forget foreign enemies and terrorism, is to permit federal government officials to have uncheckable authority to interpret the U.S. Constitution in defining their powers. Quote, if the federal government has the exclusive right to judge the extent of its own powers, warned the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions authors Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, it will continue to grow, regardless of elections, the separation of powers, and other much-toted limits on government power, unquote. This is especially true since currently the Constitution's 10th Amendment that strictly limits the possible extent of federal government powers and the Constitution's strict process of amendment are openly ignored under the doctrine of a living Constitution. For Alaska not to take action concerning the constitutionally moral principle of nullification is to make the U.S. Pledge of Allegiance a cheap chant for lemmings. To strengthen this legislation, I recommend several almost self-evident changes. Bill page 2, line 1 and 2 should be modified to read federal law and regulations or presidential executive orders that are not properly adopted in accordance with constitutional and statutory authority are not laws of the U.S. for the purposes of the Supremacy Clause. The rest of the bill's language should be modified to be consistent with these proposed changes. An additional legislative finding should approximately read, federal law and regulations or presidential executive orders not complying to or respecting the Constitution's 10th Amendment depend on forcing the Constitution to be inconsistent and in conflict with itself in order to gain apparent legitimacy in the confusion. Such efforts are not only unconstitutional, but anti-constitutional and must earn wide condemnation. Lastly, this bill should provide that, in addition to any state legislation formulated using a governor-signed Alaska nullification resolution and its documentation, the Attorney General shall obtain the support of a fast-tracked Alaska Supreme Court injunction against the offending law, regulation, presidential executive order in Alaska. The injunction is intended to provide the time for Alaska to sue the federal government for relief from and punishment of its unconstitutional behavior. Coordinated use of the three branches of government combined with using established national legal paths will avoid the secessionist label that has castrated states' rights for 150 years. Gentlemen, good luck in your deliberations.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thompson. Didn't expect somebody to be that thorough, but from what I guess you're saying is wherever we say federal regulations, you're interested in saying federal law in addition to federal regulations and presidential executive orders not complying with the 10th Amendment that are unconstitutional, etc. Is that pretty much the gist of what you had wanted to do?
I mean, I can't read the 10th Amendment. I would like to point out that there was an incident where one of the Supreme Court justices asked a lawyer that was in court if they could give any examples of limitations or where the Constitution limited the use of the Commerce Clause in federal government activity. The lawyer could not give any examples of where the Constitution limited it, which seems to be a high contradiction. So that's why this issue is a very serious one to be looked at.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
You're quite welcome.
Anyone else online that wants to testify? Seeing and hearing none, close public testimony, bringing it back to the committee. Mr. Thompson had made some suggestions. Representative Keller, and what he did was on the top of page 2, where it said federal regulations, the first two words, where he added the word federal law and federal regulations, and then he also added not in compliance with the 10th Amendment. If indeed anyone wanted to offer an amendment, I would accept it now. Otherwise, we will we'll vote on the bill as it stands. No amendments. Oh, the Department of Law amendment, which you're referring to?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keller.
I want to comment that Mr. Thompson's comments are consistent with the intent of the sponsor. And but before I committed to that, I would like to hear from my staff, chief of staff on this, who has spent a lot of time on the bill, whether or not he recommends an amendment to include law, because it's not clear to me why or why not, except that it's intent, you know, it sounds great.
Mr. Pound, you've already introduced yourself, so proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly this is, in its subsection, an issue of the Supremacy Clause versus the 10th Amendment. Supremacy Clause saying that what is passed by Congress is the law of the land. The case that we cite in this particular bill, which is the New York City versus FCC, is our Supreme Court ruling that also includes statutes. There have since been rulings that says, well, it's only regulations. That only includes regulations if Congress so intended. And then there's standing having to do with whether certain departments within the federal government have the authority to enforce certain laws if it has to do with criminal activity, which is normally local. The 10th Amendment aspect of it is certainly something we talked about in the office on the comparison. This bill is very much Supremacy Clause versus 10th Amendment. And the 10th Amendment is that the powers given to the federal government are limited, essentially. I mean, I can read it. I have a copy of it here if you would like me to read it on the record.
Can you do it in a minute?
I can do it probably quicker than that if I can find it. I can do both, actually, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Supremacy law of the land. Supremacy clause is number 2. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made of which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state or to the contrary notwithstanding. The 10th Amendment is powers reserved to the states or people. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And those are the two argument points of that we're dealing with in various regulations and laws. I don't believe, and we certainly even see it at the state level, where regulations pop up quite often that really don't follow the intent of the legislature, because either they don't pay attention or they don't care. And at the federal level, we have the same situation.
Well, the thought that the Constitution is a living document really surprised me the first time I heard that. If that's a living document, then then we have no standards. Everything can be reinterpreted depending on what year it is and what the current direction that the country is more curious about, which might reverse in 10 years, and then we can reverse the laws again. So I'm a constitutionalist, and I think we ought to go by what it says exactly and not by thinking of it as a document that isn't rigid.
Somebody through the chair, if you don't mind, we certainly don't want a repeat of what's going on in Egypt right now.
Right, because the person now deposed could change the Constitution at will.
And now the military has done that by abolishing it completely, sir.
Now, we do have an amendment here, and I'm going to take a little brief at ease here. Since there's no... We're live. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to make a conceptual amendment using the wording to start with here that has been presented to us from the Department of Law, and I'll read it into the record. Delete page 2, lines 22 through 29, and insert the words paragraph H. If the Attorney General finds that a regulation or presidential executive order has the effect of preempting state law and that the regulation or order is unconstitutional or was not properly adopted, the Attorney General shall report the findings to the chairs of the House and Senate committees having jurisdiction over judicial matters, and then the report must include, and then the rest of the bill stays the same. So that's the conceptual amendment. Okay.
So there's conceptual amendment number 1. Is there an objection to conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing and hearing none, conceptual amendment number 1 is adopted. This brings us back to the bill. Representative Thompson.
Chairman Gatto, I move that we advance House Bill 8 as conceptually amended, along with the physical note and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill moves from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And do we have a third bill?
No. No. The Department of Law said I would give you one for the today, so I think
okay, so we can adjourn. Okay. Having no other business before us, the committee adjourns at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much.